a Birdificer creation.
Welcome to Let's Talk Apple, episode 154. I'm your host, Bart Buschotz, and this is the show for June 2026. June is always a busy month, but June 2026 takes the cake. So, without much more faffing about, we should get stuck into all that news. But before I do, just a reminder that you will find detailed show notes at letstalk.ie. Or in the case of today's show, letstalk.ie/LTA154. And the reason I'm calling it out at the start of the show is that because there is in fact so much nuance and detail to the news, there is a lot more in the show notes than I'm going to get time to say here on the show itself. The show notes are a full list of all of the reading that has informed my thinking on the month's Apple news. And not all of my thinking can quite make it into the show. So, with all of that said, let's get stuck into the June 2026 news. Just one piece of follow-up from last month's show. Last month I did something very unusual. I talked about a report, an unconfirmed report, as if it were news. Now, the reason for this is quite simply because it's a very, very strong report, and it almost certainly is actually correct. And we got a tiny bit more possible maybe confirmation. What am I talking about? Well, it seems very clear that Intel are about to start producing Apple Silicon using their new foundry setup. And the President of the United States, who would normally be a very trustworthy source, just let it slip that that was definitely happening, and that Apple were ready to sign a chip-making deal with Intel on his personal blog, otherwise known as Truth Social. He, of course, provided nothing to actually back up that assertion, so take it for what it's worth. Moving on to a regulatory rundown, India's case against Apple seemed, at the start of the month, like it was about to get resolved until it wasn't. So at the start of the month, we had India's $38 billion antitrust case inches forward as Apple finally agrees to cooperate, was the headline Apple Insider put on it. A quote from their article, Apple has given up trying to withhold its financial details from India's antitrust body, although it did negotiate one last delay and may have managed to greatly cut up to $38 billion fine it was staring down. And then, as we got to the end of the month, Apple basically said, actually, India's $38 billion antitrust case is plagiarized and should be scrapped. Again, from Apple Insider, quoting their story, Apple appeared to be finally cooperating with India's antitrust regulator, but now says it can show that the country's three-year investigation consisted of simply copying and pasting claims from rivals. So much for that one rounding down. Meanwhile, in Europe, Italy opens a Digital Markets Act investigation into Apple over iCloud backup access. This is yet another example of the Digital Markets Act being abused to undermine users' privacy. The European Union has extremely strong privacy regulations, and I really wish they'd remember that before they start going after Apple for everything else. Anyway, it's only the start of an investigation, so no need to panic just yet. Meanwhile, other side of the Atlantic Ocean, in Brazil, EU-style App Store rules reach Brazil with new stores and payments. To quote Apple's press release, Apple is bringing alternative app marketplaces and payment options to iPhone users in Brazil under an agreement with the country's antitrust regulator, extending App Store changes that were previously limited to the European Union. This is not particularly surprising because Brazil has been quite heavily fighting for these kind of changes, and so Apple just copying and pasting what they did in Europe makes all the sense in the world. And then finally, two stories from the United Kingdom. First off, a UK watchdog pushes Apple to loosen App Store payment and NFC rules. Okay then. And Apple takes a $502 million patent case to the US Supreme Court. That is a case over 4G LTE patents against the company Optus, or by the company Optus against Apple. Again, that is an important one because the whole point of those LTE 4G patents is that they're supposed to be friend, fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory, and I'm not entirely sure that's how things are going. Again, those two cases will do their thing. From regulation to its cousin legal cases, XAI versus Apple hasn't gone particularly well for Elon Musk, but then again, it's a very silly lawsuit anyway, so I'm not particularly sad about this. Singapore has rejected XAI's document request. They wanted basically a whole bunch of stuff handed over about Apple and OpenAI, and that's not happening. And what is happening, because when you launch a lawsuit, one reason you're not supposed to launch frivolous lawsuits is because it opens you up to discovery from the other side, who are probably quite cranky with you for opening up a frivolous lawsuit. It's fair to say Apple are quite cranky with Elon Musk, and they have tried to use, and are succeeding in using, discovery to make Elon's life a little bit more miserable by requiring his SpaceX and Tesla email accounts. Apple and Epic then in the United States. Well, the month started off with just the usual posturing. So we had Apple Supreme Court appeal should be thrown out, says Epic. Apple says Epic's own filing proves the Supreme Court should hear the appeal. Well, at the end of the month, we found out that the Supreme Court would appear to believe Apple over Epic in terms of that little back and forth because, ta-da-da-da, US Supreme Court agrees to hear Apple's Epic Games appeal. At least it's going up to the highest court in the land. Now, the highest court in the land has every bit of power to kick it back down to the lower courts with a bit more guidance. So the fact that it's reached the highest court doesn't mean it's nearly over, but it is nonetheless a very significant step that it is all the way up to the Supreme Court now. So stay tuned. Then we have Apple versus the leakers. John Prosser gets another chance to fight the Apple lawsuit. Basically, to quote the Mac Observer, Apple and tech leaker John Prosser have jointly asked a federal court to set aside the default entered against him in the ongoing lawsuit over alleged leak of iOS 26's liquid glass redesign. If the court approves the request, Prosser will regain the opportunity to formally respond to Apple's claims and continue defending himself in the case. Well, that is exactly what the judge did. The default was set aside. John Prosser was given 10 days to submit his response, and just before I recorded this show, that's exactly what he did. As Apple Insider headline it, leaker John Prosser denies Apple's charges and blames everything on his co-defendant. Well, that's nice of you. Throw him under the bus, eh? And then finally, a class action lawsuit from a number of YouTubers against Apple has gotten Apple to respond. They want the case dismissed, but their argument for requesting the case be dismissed is that YouTube videos are in fact public and that Apple in fact did not in any way bypass any sort of technical restrictions, which means that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, which is what the case was filed under, literally doesn't apply as Apple sees it. My understanding of the DMCA is that Apple are probably right here. My understanding of copyright law is that while the ethics of training your model on other people's published stuff are a whole different question that are not really part of the law, the copyright law is pretty clear that it's fair use, unless there's a major change in precedent. So, as unpopular and as morally grey as Apple's stance is, I do think it's on pretty firm legal footing, so we shall see what happens. I am, of course, not a lawyer, so take that with all the grains of salt you think it deserves. Apple HR and acquisition news, then. Despite getting a lot of support, Apple has confirmed permanent closure dates for three US stores, including the Towson store, Apple's first ever unionized store. And that was then followed later in the month by the headline, Apple is closing 3 US stores today amid mal decline and union dispute. When I say there was a lot of support for the workers, we had 40 members of Congress, we had the Maryland governor, and the mayor of Baltimore, all siding with the workers, but alas, all to no avail. Meanwhile, OpenAI has poached another Apple executive from its from Apple's hardware division. Same thing, really. Paul Mead, Apple VP of Hardware Engineering for Vision Products Group, is joining OpenAI's hardware unit. So this is someone who would have worked with Jony Ive going back to work with Jony Ive. Jony has been busy getting his former Apple colleagues to go join him, so this is not a shock, and it's not like there aren't enough people in the giant big spaceship in Cupertino anyway, but nonetheless, another notable move from Apple to OpenAI. Meanwhile, we have one acquisition under HR and Acquisitions. Apple acquires Play, an award-winning SwiftUI prototyping tool. Award-winning as in Apple gave it an award. The Apple Design Awards, in fact. So I can see why it came to Apple's attention. Apple services and original content. Just a few highlights. Shocking absolutely no one, given that the Soccer World Cup is currently on. Mini Football Legends is one of the games coming to Apple Arcade, as well as Family Feud Pocket, which is definitely a good fun game for anyone who's familiar with the very famous American game show. And in fact, 7 more games. So that's a total of 9 games coming to Apple Arcade. Pretty good, but then again, it is summer holiday time, so lots to keep the kids entertained while you're on long car journeys, I guess. Meanwhile, Apple Music Classical and Wingmore Hall have announced a new partnership, to quote the Mac Observer. As part of Wingmore Hall's 125th anniversary celebrations, Wingmore Hall Live is relaunching as a digital-only service with a model that sends all recording royalties directly to performers. That's kind of cool. Apple Pay Transit is now working in 14 major US cities. That's not bad at all. I could list all the cities, but I forgot to put them into the show notes. And you know something? I'm just going to leave it to you, if you live in the United States, to go to the link in the show notes to the Mac Observer article, which does in fact list all the cities. Meanwhile, if you are an Amex cardholder, which I believe is just Americans, I don't believe Amex exists outside of America. It's short for American Express, that's what it was when I was a child, now it's just Amex. Anyway, if you are an Amex cardholder and you have membership rewards and you use Apple Pay, you can now access those membership rewards as part of the Apple Pay checkout process, which is kind of cool. And then finally, 2 stories from Apple TV land. First off, the Formula One Austrian Grand Prix will be free on Apple TV. This is part of their big deal to show Formula One, so making that available for free turns it into a very effective advertisement for the Apple TV service. And in related news, Schmigadoon, the former Apple TV TV show, which was cancelled despite being really quite popular, it didn't stop just because it stopped being a TV show. It became a musical, which means it was able to earn awards in that category as well as awards in the television categories. And by doing so, Apple has ended up with a so-called EGOT, an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar and Tony. So basically, Apple shows have gotten Apple at least one of each of those very prestigious awards. EGOTs are not easy to come to, because despite being around a lot longer than Apple TV, Netflix haven't got an EGOT yet. So I don't really think it's Apple's strategy, but hey, Apple have an EGOT. If you get the feeling I've been rushing a little bit to get to the main stories, that would be because I've been rushing a little bit to get to the main stories. We only have 2. We have the, well, 2. A giant big story made up of lots of little stories and another story. The giant big story made up of lots of little stories is, of course, the Worldwide Developer Conference, WWDC 2026. And the other story is, unfortunately, that all the AI shenanigans has really driven up the cost of certain components and, unusually for Apple, they have raised their prices. Where do we begin with the Worldwide Developer Conference? Always so much news because, of course, yes, there's the keynote everyone thinks of, the public one. That's like an hour and a bit long, not that long. Well, that keynote is in fact only half of the really important keynotes, because actually the more important keynote for a lot of people is the State of the Platforms keynote, which is the afternoon of the same day, which is the keynote for developers. And that is, after all, the Worldwide Developer Conference we're talking about here. And, of course, both of those keynotes are just on day one of a great big conference. So in actual fact, there's lots and lots and lots of news that's been breaking all month that's triggered by WWDC. So where do we begin? Well, I'm going to do what I've done the last couple of years, and let's break it down by what Apple considers to be important. We're just going to read the headlines of Apple's press releases to whet our appetite, and then we'll dive in a bit more detail. So, in the run-up to WWDC, Apple always put out a bunch of press releases. So, we have Apple reveals winners of the 2026 Design Awards. They're always worth a look at, by the way. Always some fun apps in there. I just downloaded a new app for getting myself the latest Tide information for those few times a year I go to the seaside. Europe's first Apple Developer Center to open in Berlin. And then we have an Apple-funded study which finds that App Store ecosystem reaches around $1.4 trillion as developers continue to thrive globally. Well, the word ecosystem is doing some very heavy lifting there, because it's a very, very, very broad brush Apple are painting with. If you want to understand exactly why there isn't that much to read into this, maybe you should have a look at Apple Insider's taken it. Their headline is, App Store ecosystem surges to $1.4 trillion globally in 2025 from a certain point of view. And the other thing that's interesting is an awful lot of the growth is being driven by using Apple's on-device AI models. So Apple AI on-device is actually proving to be quite valuable to developers developing really quite powerful tools. More detail on that from the linked Cult of Mac story in the show notes at lessertalk.ie. So now we've arrived at the keynote, or at the conference, which starts with the keynote. And then we have a lot of Apple press releases. First, we have Apple Intelligence brings powerful AI capabilities to everyday experiences. Followed by, due to Digital Markets Act, Siri AI delayed in European Union for iOS 27 and iPadOS 27. That's before the next PR press release. Apple introduces Siri AI, a profoundly more capable and personal assistant. Apple expands App Store capabilities to help developers grow their business and reach new users. Apple unveils next-generation Apple Intelligence Siri AI, powerful parental controls, and an expansive set of software improvements. That's Apple's summary of the conference as a whole. That's followed by a more detailed press release about those child safety features. Then we have Apple accelerates app development with new intelligence frameworks and advanced tools. That's aimed at developers. And then finally, Apple introduces innovative features and intelligence experiences across services. So a little, didn't really get any play during the keynote, but it's become quite traditional to get an update on the services during the week of WWDC, and that's indeed what happened. If you would like to watch the main event from a public point of view, link in the show notes to where you can watch the keynote video. But actually, I also have a link in the show notes to the where you can get to the real keynote for developers and techies like me. So I always watch the State of the Platforms, so that is also linked. Of the big things Apple announced, let's get the easier one out of the way, which is parental control. So Apple's philosophy here is quite different to what various governments seem to be trying to do. And I'm just going to quote Apple, Apple's VP of Health and Fitness, Dr. Sambol Desai. Our approach to helping families create safer digital experiences grounded in the belief that every child is unique And that's why we build simple and intuitive tools based on expert guidance to let parents tailor their kids' digital journey. I cannot but applaud that approach. The top-down government knows best of how you should parent your kids approach is not really a good approach, because it means that the most conservative view will always win, and it means that the complete uniqueness of every child at every age is completely and utterly ignored. The people who know your kid best are you, the parent, not a minister somewhere in a government office. And this is kind of why I like California's law, which requires the companies empower the parents. And this is what Apple is doing. So I completely approve of this approach. Apple have also created a dedicated page for parents called Child Safety on apple.com. That is linked in the show notes. And Apple actually developed a suite of tools with the American Academy of Pediatrics. So summarizing all of the changes, a lot of it, by the way, is making the stuff that technically sort of kind of exists already actually work. Because the biggest complaint I hear from parents who try to use Apple's features is that they sound great in theory until you try to implement them, and then they're buggy as all heck. Apparently, they're not buggy as all heck anymore, and they've gotten better and more intuitive and easier to use and so forth, as best as I can tell, and the beta seem to bear that out. So, breaking down what's in here, the main sort of features that I could see, family and child accounts are the cornerstone of the system, so easier to create child accounts, and they will initialize with expert recommended defaults. So instead of having the parent have to play a game of 20 questions, you give the parent a starting point that's based on the average, which again, average is not appropriate for all children, but it's not a bad starting point. And it's a lot easier for a parent to scroll through a bunch of averages and go, well, that makes sense, that makes sense. Oh, no, no, that's not appropriate for my Bobby. I'll change that one, right? Much, much easier to do. So that's a very good way to do it. Parents can decide what apps child accounts can install, and there's even a feature for children to request an app. So a nice, easy flow. Parents also get control over who kids can contact. Now, at the moment, that is through first-party apps. There is an API, so in theory, every messaging app could start to implement this feature, but that would involve them adopting the API. There's no cost to that apart from time, effort, and, well, wanting. Parents can also control where kids browse, as long as they use Safari at least, and there's also a mechanism for kids to request access to specific sites they want to access. So again, a nice, easy flow. And finally, screen time has been completely redesigned. And they have the new concept of allowances, which means that instead of it being fixed times that you have to, you know, oh, you can play from 4 to 6. No, no, you have an allowance for how much playing you can do, and then you can't play anymore. It seems like a very sensible approach. Yeah, if you want to read more, link in the show notes. iOS 27, Apple's child safety overhaul, everything announced from the Mac Observer. They keep on prefixing everything with iOS 27 because that's by far the most popular platform. But really, in almost every headline about this keynote, about this whole conference that you read, in almost all of them, you can substitute the word iOS for Apple OS, because generally speaking, Apple unified everything across all their platforms, but for some reason the headlines all scream about the one that's installed on the most phones, which is of course iOS. An example, you can create app schedules for school hours in iOS 27, and that is from the Mac Observer as well. It's an interesting little example of how these tools work. Practical, hands-on from the betas. So that's the first major feature, is parental controls. By far, the most important other feature is Apple Intelligence Take 2, as I'm calling it. The first story linked right at the headline in the show notes is from Mac Stories, and I really want to commend Mac Stories for doing amazing overview articles on everything to do with AI, and in fact with all of the OS updates from WWDC. The folks over there at Mac Stories do truly excellent work, and it's not just a few people, well, it's still only a handful of people, but it's a lot more people than just Federico Viticci and Mr. Voorhees. It's quite a few different bylines I'm seeing there now, and they're all doing amazing work. So the first thing I have done, which is very unusual, I have included a diagram in the show notes, again, let's-talk.ie. And this diagram I'm allowed to insert because it's from Apple PR and it is licensed for me to include as long as I don't edit it, which I have not. And the reason this diagram is at the top is because there are a lot of different words that sound the same but aren't the same. The most important ones are the concept of Apple intelligence, which is the whole. All the features are Apple intelligence. So Apple intelligence is the whole pie. And then there are parts within the pie. And one of those parts is Siri AI. And this distinction becomes extremely important when we go look at the giant big controversy, which is the EU blocking Siri AI on iOS, because iOS is a so-called gatekeeper. So before we jump to that lovely little bit of nuance, let us look at this diagram. So this is part technical detail, part pretty picture, part marketing. So this very interesting diagram, because it isn't technically anything, and yet it still conveys a lot of information. So at the very center of the concentric circles, the diagram is concentric circles, a very center is the person, you. Around you are all of your Apple devices, your Apple Watch, your iPhone, your iPad, your Apple Vision Pro, if you live in one of the few countries that can have them, and your Mac. And then around all of that is where the AI layers begin. So the Apple Foundation models are probably the most important part of that, and they understand three modes. So they're multimodal models, image, voice, and text. Around those models, then, we have the system orchestrator. And the system orchestrator has a whole bunch of moving parts. So there is world knowledge being layered on top of those foundation models. So foundation models, the next layer up is one of the next layers up is world knowledge. Another layer on top of those foundation models is actions. The ability for Apple AI to do things, which is through something called app intents, which are exactly the same mechanism that have been powering shortcuts for many years. There is now on-screen awareness, which is this image mode being used to interpret what's visually on your screen, so Apple intelligence can reason about what you are seeing without you having to take a screenshot and submit it to it. It can just see your screen and interpret it. And then you have something which is not yet part of shortcuts, personal context. So app intents allow any app to describe to the system as a whole what they can do. That's how the shortcuts app can work, is the app intents. And that is also how Apple intelligence interacts with apps, is through those app intents. But there's a second part to that same concept of app intents, which is not the what the app can do, but to the what the app knows. And this is so-called personal context. So there is an API for developers to label in a standard way the pieces of information they contain. So I know something about a person. That person has these identifying features, which means that information about my mum in every single app will have a consistent piece of metadata that says this is information about a person and that information is about Bart's mum. And then there are specific types of pieces of information that the app can declare itself as holding, which then allows Siri to use, Apple Intelligence as a whole, shortcuts in theory possibly as well in the future, but the whole Apple Intelligence system, to ask those apps for all the information they have about people named Bob, or for all the information they have about events, or for all the information they have about relationships between people, or etc., etc., etc. So the personal context allows the app to describe in a standardized way that all apps share, a common language between all apps, of what they know. And your app intents are of what they can do in a common language everyone agrees on. And that makes it possible for the really clever stuff to happen around the edges, which is the so-called system-wide experiences. And a really, really, really big one of those is Siri AI, which is levering all of that ability in those lower layers. There are also apps that lever all of that ability in those lower layers. And that looks smaller in the diagram because it's only four letters. But apps is a very broad term. So yes, Siri AI is a big part of the outer edge of Apple intelligence. It's not all of it. There's a lot going on here that everyone in Europe still gets to have. And we are, unfortunately, on iOS going to be missing Siri AI, which is one of the things on the outside layer of this nested circles of Apple intelligence. Right, let's just get it out of the way. This Siri AI in Europe thing. So the headlines tend to paint with a pretty broad brush, or pretty broad brush, because that's easier to do. And they tend to say things like, Apple intelligence is not available in Europe. Which is wrong on at least two levels. So the first level I've already hinted at quite a few times is that it's only Siri AI that is affected by the European issue. And to be clear, Apple have chosen not to release it because they think they'll get in trouble if they do. This contrasts with what Google chose to do, which is release it and see what happens. So Apple are being a little bit cleverer here. They don't really want to have this fight. Now, there's some more nuance we'll get to later. But the first thing I really want to make clear is the scope here. So Siri AI is the scope, which makes sense because we have Apple Intelligence now. So we get to keep Apple Intelligence. What we don't get to have is new Siri. We, unfortunately, are for an amount of time, which, and it's not actually clear what that amount of time is, for an amount of time, we are stuck with silly Siri. And this is very annoying because silly Siri is very silly. And actually, it gets a little bit more frustrating because the Digital Markets Act applies very, very, very different rules to companies that are designated as gatekeepers. This is not an unusual legal concept. It is, in fact, the core concept on antitrust. If you have a monopoly, then you have more rules binding your behavior because you have the power to squash competition. And the Digital Markets Act is ultimately an antitrust law. It's not one of Europe's many privacy laws. It's not Europe's law about giving consumers rights. That's the Digital Services Act. The Digital Markets Act is about competition. It's an antitrust law. And so, in order for that antitrust law to apply, you need to be in a position where you dominate a market. iOS dominates the smartphone market. Therefore, iOS is designated a gatekeeper. Therefore, iOS has to be very open to competitors. Not because every platform has to be open, it's because every platform that's close to being a monopoly has to be open. And there are rules about how you count whether or not your platform is a gatekeeper. And iOS meets that bar. What doesn't meet that bar is the Mac. Because Apple's market share in terms of desktop operating systems, or personal computer operating systems, let's say, is really quite small. So Microsoft's a gatekeeper. They have to abide by all sorts of rules. But the Mac, not a gatekeeper. So on our Macs, we will have full Siri AI. So we will get used to Siri not being silly. And then we'll pick up our phones and Siri will be silly again. And then we'll go back to our Macs and Siri will be very smart again. And then we'll go back to our phones and it'll be silly again. This is going to get annoying. Let's be blunt. Another interesting little note is that there are two other platforms that are not designated gatekeepers. And there's no fundamental reason why they would have to be affected by this ban. But they are affected because Apple chose to make a very specific technological choice. I am talking about CarPlay and watchOS, because CarPlay pretty much entirely is a projection of your phone. CarPlay doesn't run on your car. CarPlay is basically allowed to talk to your car, and it can read some information from the car and send some information to the car, but it's basically an external display for your iPhone. So it's iOS. Therefore, it's a gatekeeper. Therefore, it, because of how Apple chose to put Apple's operating systems into cars, is also covered sort of as collateral damage. And while the Apple Watch has a lot more independence than CarPlay, it's still like early iPods or iPod Touches or indeed early iPhones. It's still tethered to, so in the same way that early iPhones were tethered to Macs and you needed to use iTunes to manage them, well, the Apple Watch is still very much tethered to iPhones and you need to use the Watch app on your iPhone to manage your Apple Watch. And so it too, unfortunately, is also affected by iOS being a gatekeeper. There's no technological reason Apple can't make the same shift of liberating the Apple Watch from the iPhone in the way they liberated the iPhone from the Mac, but they are not at that point in the Apple Watch's evolution yet. So that's the scope of these things. Now, Apple made it very clear in their press release, which they got out first, that they had drafted a very detailed proposal about a privacy-preserving mechanism for opening up basically personal context and app intents to third parties to directly compete with Siri AI on iPhones. That's a big deal. But that's difficult. That's basically a whole new security model that will take a lot of time and effort. So Apple basically said, here's our design. It will take us 18 months to implement. First and foremost, before we commit to 18 months of work, is this good enough? Is this going to meet your needs? Secondary to that, as a, oh, if it is good enough, how about we get an 18-month delay so that European users don't lose out while we do this work? And the European Union really seemed to take offense at the second minor ask, the, oh, maybe ask, and don't seem to have given even the slightest bit of fair consideration to the primary ask, which is, hey, before we do 18 months of work, how about you give us a steer? How about you tell us now whether we're on the right path? Because it's actually utterly unrealistic to tell us to suck it and see. And I'm with Apple on this one. I'm with the intent of the Digital Markets Act. But the European Commission is made up of politicians who, while not elected to the European Commission, are formally elected politicians from countries, and they are extremely political animals. And so because the Commission is made up of bureaucrats, but the commissioners run the Commission, and they are political appointees, and oh boy, are they political. And basically, they love grandstanding. And so they love sticking it to the man, putting it up to those big Yankee companies, and yeah, I'm using that word. They intended to be insulting, that's why I'm using it. I know it's an insulting word. That's their attitude. And that is utterly destroying the concept, because the letter of the law of the Digital Markets Act actually says that there will be no fines applied to companies who cooperate with the Commission. Apple are literally trying to do what the law says and cooperate with the Commission, but for purely politics reasons, the commissioners, who are the political appointees, are playing politics with the whole thing. And they released a press release which doesn't actually contradict any of the facts, but wow, does it put a different spin on things. Basically, I will just quote the European Commission, and you can make up your own mind. So I've told you what Apple actually asked for, and this is how the commissioner responded. The decision not to roll out Siri AI in the EU is Apple's and Apple's only. Apple was simply unable to develop interoperability solutions that meet essential EU privacy and security standards. Instead of trying to find a suitable compliance solution, Apple simply made a request to the European Commission to be exempted from their interoperability obligations under the DMA, at least, and this for at least 18 months. That's not an option. I'm sorry, that is utterly twisting what Apple actually asked for. That's a disgraceful, disgraceful answer. And as a proud European, I'm pretty bloody cranky to see the Commission twisting a good law so badly. This is why people think Europe is a basket case. Because this is crackpot crazy. Right. Don't just take my word for it. The Washington Post have a good analysis of these things. They use the euphemism Brussels to describe the European Commission, which, as a proud Belgian, I'm a little bit cranky about, but let's go with it here, quoting from the New Washington Post. Brussels insists the decision is apples and apples only, and that nothing in its flagship Digital Markets Act forbids the launch. That's technically true and wholly beside the point. The law requires that the moment Siri AI ships in Europe, any rival AI agent must get the same sweeping access to the user's messages, files and chat history. Apple proposed putting in a software security layer to make that safe and offered a phased rollout to build it. According to Apple, the European Union rejected the proposal. Daft. Now, it looked like all the news was bad for Europeans. But just before I went to record this, a little unverified report leaked out that Tim Cook is already putting on his new hat as chief diplomat of Apple. He's still chief CEO, chief whatever officer, executive officer. But he also seems to be trying on his new hat because Tim Cook talks with EU tech chief to resolve the Siri AI standoff. Apparently it was a constructive call. I bloody well hope so. In related news then, I've already hinted at this. A few months ago, the European Commission ruled that Google's integration of Gemini and Androids violates the Digital Markets Act. So as John Gruber summarizes this, the difference between Google and Apple on this front is that Google just blazed ahead and simply shipped Gemini integrated in Android in the EU and is now facing compliance problems after shipping. I think Apple's doing this the better way around. And in related news that's not actually to do with this particular thing, this goes back all the way to 2018 when Google were saying that if you want Android and you want the Play Store, then you must prioritize a whole bunch of our services, including search. That is literally textbook anti-competitive. The European Commission fined Google before the Digital Markets Act even existed under plain old antitrust laws way back in 2018. And that has now withstood the final appeal and has been upheld by Europe's top court. So the appeal is over. 4.1 billion euro in damages is now owed. So one approach is just to plough ahead and pay the fines and deal with it. The other approach is to try negotiate up front. And you know something? Apple should be rewarded for trying to negotiate up front. The contrast to Google's behaviour should be rewarded, not used as an opportunity to score silly political points. So yet again, the more I talk about this, the crankier I get about all of this. Whew. Okay, this is why I wanted to get this out of the way at the top here. So let's move on to the more interesting stuff. And an immediate thing I want to really focus on here is understanding the relationship between Gemini and Apple Intelligence, because you know something, unless you're a computer scientist, it's not actually that bloody simple. One reason it's not that bloody simple is because Google just used the one name, Gemini, for a whole bunch of actually different concepts. It's a bit like Microsoft's approach of calling everything, actually they just call everything a different name every week. But again, we just use one name for everything, right? Skype became what was Link. Anyway, let's not even go there. Naming in Microsoft. Blech. So, Apple are not actually using a single Gemini model. Yes, they paid Google a lot of money to use Gemini to build Apple Intelligence, and they absolutely have used Gemini to build Apple Intelligence. But Apple Foundation models, which are right at the heart of that circle, when you leave out the squishy organic bit and the actual, you know, the shape of the hardware, those foundation models are Apple's own. Apple trained them. And where Gemini comes in, so they're not Gemini models, rebranded, they're Apple's own models, which at the end of Apple's training process, they are augmented with additional sort of fine-tuning against Gemini. This is something called distilling in the industry. And distilling is an interesting practice because it's certainly against all the terms of service of all the big model makers, because it's a way of basically leeching off those other models. Grok have just brazenly said, yeah, we distill all the models. come sue us if you want. Whereas Apple have done, again, a very different thing, where they have paid Google to officially distill the model. So Gemini was used to knock the rough edges off Apple's own models. It's a way of getting Apple's models to go from good to great, from good enough, which isn't really good enough, to apparently, based on the betas, really bloody good. So there is Gemini help, but there's no Gemini stuff running. Apple have also worked with Google to expand private cloud compute to run on Google hardware in Google data centers. But it's Apple's private cloud compute, so all of Apple's privacy guarantees remain in place. Yes, the physical data center where the stuff is happening is in Google's data centers, some of it now, some of it still in Apple's, but your privacy is completely and utterly unchanged. So Gemini isn't even seeing this, because it's not Gemini, it's Apple's own models running on Google's hardware, but fully encrypted end-to-end, so that those servers are just crunching meaningless numbers. Just like Apple's own servers are crunching meaningless numbers because of end-to-end encryption. So if all of that is too confusing and you want someone else to explain it to you, or if you want even more nerdy details, again, Mac Stories have an excellent, really quite geeky dive into this third generation of Apple's foundation models. Linked in the show notes at letustalk.ie. Okay, with all of that said, the Apple Intelligence features. Well, basically, if you want a list of them all, link in the show notes to Mac Observer, but some of the highlights: Image Playground gets realistic AI image generation. Apple's new AI-era-powered Extend and Reframe image tools are the real deal, the cause of Mac found when running the beta. So Extend is like a feature we've had in Photoshop for years. Imagine you shoot a photograph and you've cropped a little bit too much off the edges when you were framing it, or you want to turn it into a very, very wide shot to fit at the top of a blog post, but you didn't shoot it wide enough. Well, we can now use generative AI to just make the picture bigger. And Apple Intelligence will fill in the gaps realistically. That's called generative fill in the Photoshop world, and now it's coming to Apple's Photos app. That's cool. Then the other one is the reframe. So if you shoot something straight on, or from a little bit lower shooting up, or from a little bit higher shooting down, you end up with a very, very, very different photograph. And what Apple allow you to do with this really very clever tool is to move the camera after you've taken the picture. It starts by using a depth map, which allows us to then to add the perspective, and then it lets you move the camera after the fact. But of course, there are things that were obscured from where your camera really was that would be visible where you've now moved your camera to. So there's little bits of reality to fill in, and those are filled in with generative AI to give you realistic images. And assuming you don't go too far with the feature, it works extremely well. But of course, it is making up data. It's guessing at what would be there if you had had your camera so it could have seen it. So the more you do it, the more artificial, the more fake the photo gets. If you do it a little bit, you're getting like 1% of your image is fake, which is very, very different to doing giant big changes where it's loads of it is generated. Interesting, interesting feature. Very powerful processing going on here. Then we have simpler stuff like video summaries and smarter alerts in the Home app. So if you're using Apple's secure video on your home system, well, it will tell you using like English what happened. Hey, a raccoon stole your bins. Or you have all of those alerts coming together saying, your sensor's on, your sensor's off, your sensor's on, your sensor's off. It's like, no, the garage door opened and closed four times. It's like, oh, okay, that's actually useful. So that's kind of good. Again, we have this multimodal model, so Apple Calendar app adds better natural language support. Also, because all of this is around App Intents, you can now have Shortcuts build its own shortcut for you by you giving it a plain text English prompt. And in the betas, Apple Insider have been playing around with it, and according to their report, linked in the show notes, it actually works pretty well. Then a really powerful feature, which is actually a really good example of agentic AI, is that the Passwords app has a feature where it can automatically change weak passwords for you, which is very powerful. I'm very curious to see that working for Reels, but it's a very interesting feature, because the biggest chore with you know, you tell everyone, hey, all of these passwords are weak and all of these passwords are known to have been in data breaches. You should really change them. It's like, great. Do you have any idea how much faffing about it is to change passwords on 50 sites? Why not just have your phone do it for you automatically? Genius. If it works. Apparently, though, in the betas, it's working pretty well. So, very interesting. Now, an interesting thing here is that Apple have been increasing the capabilities of their neural engines, right? They've been adding more and more and more neural cores. And while Siri's been silly, none of us have really cared all that much how many neural cores our phone has. But those cores were being put in for a reason. Apple have been working on Apple intelligence that isn't silly for a long time now. The fact that they failed to ship for 2 years is an embarrassment to them. Their hardware was well ready, well ahead of their software. And that's now causing an interesting side effect where those people who have the higher-end devices with the more cores, the more neural engine cores, have more on-device AI than the people who don't have all of those cores because they have lower-end chips. So some of the on-device capabilities are only on some Macs and iPhones because they just have more intelligence power, more neural engines. It's like having more graphics cards, it's having more AI cards. And then if you're curious about the, because it's just everywhere, it's lots and lots and lots of little things. So a nice story from Cult of Mac, 15 great new Apple intelligence features to try beyond Siri AI. Now, I very intentionally broke this into generic Apple intelligence first, because as best as I can tell, everything I've just said is perfectly fine in Europe. And then we get to Siri AI, which is not perfectly fine in Europe on iOS, but it will be on macOS. So, as the Cult of Mac summarized it, Siri AI brings major redesign with chat interface and dedicated app. And the first thing is, Apple really did start over, and Mike Rockwell, the lead of Siri engineering, was pretty explicit about it when interviewed. Last year, we had actually built the first version of this that was sort of incremental on top of the original Siri that added tool calling, and we had it working. But we didn't feel it was really delivering on the vision and the experience that we wanted to. We also had a design which required much more extensive changes. And we decided to go with that. So we went back. We rebuilt Siri from the ground up, literally. Tore it to the ground, rebuilt it from the ground up. So instead of trying to make silly Siri less Siri, they just redid Siri. You know, hey, it's decades old, technology's moved along, what if we take the same idea and do it again based on what we know now? It's a much better approach. And again, those of us in Europe on our Macs will get intelligent Siri, and those of us in Europe on our iPhones will be stuck with silly Siri. We'll be stuck with that old model that doesn't work very well. Yay! Okay, another really important point given the utter embarrassment of their failure 2 years ago. All the demos, if they felt a bit slow in the keynote, it's because they were real time. Real demos, real time, no faking it. So what you see is what we will get. Unlike last time where it was all speculative fiction. Another important point is that unlike a lot of other AI systems, Siri AI remains private because your chat history is synced via iCloud with its end-to-end encryption in the same way your health data is synced securely. So Apple have a long history of like passwords, health data. All of this stuff is synced in such a way that not even Apple can recover it. And that same thing is happening to your chats and stuff with Siri AI. So you really have a multi-device, sort of a universally omnipresent little AI helper that remembers your past context and conversations and in fact literally can access your personal context on your device and all of your different apps that use all of these APIs. It's a spectacularly powerful, privacy-preserving way of making AI really, really serve the user instead of serving the model companies. It's such an Apple way of doing intelligence. And it's the same idea that was so amazingly, mind-bendingly brilliant 2 years ago, only this time they actually built the darn thing instead of just telling us and then not actually doing it. So all of the amazing things I said 2 years ago are now true. It didn't take a few months, it took 2 years. But hey, it's the right design. The computer science here is truly amazing, and it is actually We are the customer, not the bloody product here. That is so refreshing, because everyone keeps saying, oh, you can't do AI without giving up your privacy. Only the Google way of having everything hoovered up everywhere and fed into your profile and shared with everyone is the only way we can possibly do good Apple and good intelligence, good artificial intelligence. Has to invade your privacy or it's no good. Sorry. Wrong, wrong, wrong. This design proves it. If you're looking for more of an overview of what has changed, and the Mac Observer have a nice comparison table in their article, Siri AI versus Old Siri, Everything That Changed. Also a nice overview from the Mac Observer, New Siri, Everything Apple Announced About Its Gemini-Powered Assistant. It's not really Gemini-powered, it's Gemini-tuned. But anyway, let that slide. Another interesting point is that if your iPhone or your Mac currently support Apple Intelligence, they will support Siri AI unless you're in Europe on an iPhone or an iPad or an Apple Watch or your car. If you're curious about this whole personal context concept, there's a nice explainer from the Mac Observer linked in the show notes. And you also get control over Siri's voice in iOS 27 and macOS 27 and AppleOS 27. So you can change its expressivity and its pace. Details in a story from the Mac Observer in the show notes. Another interesting little tidbit from the many, many, many interviews various Apple executives were doing, which is actually, this one was from a fabulous interview. I've actually linked the interview in the show notes on a podcast called Mostly Human. That's a really good interview. Quite long as well. The Apple execs gave the podcast a lot of their time. Anyway, Apple explains why Siri won't look like an AI boyfriend or girlfriend. It's kind of a funny segment, but it's bloody important. They've actually made it, unlike some AI companies, that Siri won't get into a relationship with you. It won't try to pretend it's your girlfriend or your boyfriend. That's a way healthier way to have these kind of assistants. And an interesting little feature is that some of the really advanced features that have to go to private cloud computer are effectively going to be very hard on Apple's hardware resources. So they're going to be rationed. That's a negative connotation. You're going to get a certain allocation of them. But if you have iCloud Plus, you get more of them than if you don't have iCloud Plus. So yet another reason to upgrade to even the $5 a month iCloud Plus plan. Any paid for iCloud plan is iCloud Plus and gets you some nice cool features, including more Apple Intelligence usage, which is interesting. Some good opinion pieces. Really, again, John Gruber, I think, nails these things. I'm just going to quote from John Gruber. Siri AI is the only system that can draw upon your personal data in the apps on your device and perform actions based on the app intent supported by the apps on your devices. It is in some ways less capable than ChatGPT or Claude, but in other ways has way more potential. It's a very different approach, and I think it's the right one for Apple. Yeah, I'm completely on the same page as John here. Given what happened last time, as soon as the betas came out, everyone's question was, even before the betas came out during the keynote, everyone's like, will the betas include these Apple Intelligence features? Yes, they did. So there was testing going on straight away. And so there was a lot of people did testing, but I linked to Cult of Mac because I think they do really good articles on these kind of things. And D. Griffin Jones did an article where he headlined that, I tested the new Siri AI against Apple's claims. Here's how it went. Teaser, it went bloody brilliantly, to quote from Griffin. I took the three biggest demos from Apple's keynotes and replicated them with my own questions based on my own personal context. In nearly all tests, it performed just as well as Apple's examples. It's real. And it's only in beta. Yay. Okay, so as my voice begins to fade, let's now move on to the Apple OS 27 releases, because basically, the actual operating systems implement all of these features and a whole bunch of other stuff. Thankfully, the biggest feature is sort of that there aren't really that many new features apart from those, you know, the parental controls and, oh yeah, reinventing Apple Intelligence. But the other real focus was refinement. And Apple literally have compared these new operating systems to the legendary OS X Snow Leopard release. They've basically made it faster, less crashy, more robust, and they've knocked the rough edges off lots and lots and lots of little things, which is why the show notes are so bloody long, because it's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of little things. And this is the bit where I said at the start of the show that the show notes have a lot more detail than I'm going to say on air. Well, this is the bit where that happens. So the first thing is that it's all about the little things making it better, but also the features are just on every operating system. So in the olden days, I would break this section down very, very clearly by here's what's changing for Mac users and here's what's changing for iPhone users. And that's just not how it works anymore, which is why I just call it all Apple OS 27, because ultimately what they're doing, they're just doing across the board, because so much of these things share a common brain. It's a fantastic architecture. It's taken them a long time to get here. And a big part of that was the whole liquid glass redesign, because now they have a common UI language across all of their different platforms. We have common APIs, common languages. So effectively, the brains of the apps are the same across all their platforms. And the only thing that has to be redone on each platform is the user interface to match basically screen size and interface. So on the Mac, it has to work well on, you know, laptop and desktop size screens with Windows and keyboards and trackpad / mice, whereas on the iPhone, it has to work well with touching and swiping and pinching and zooming on smaller screens. On the iPad, you can have bigger screens, but it's still mostly prodding it with your finger, except when you have a keyboard and a mouse, so you have to support that too. On the watch, it's obviously whole different gestures. On the television, it's stuff you can do from your couch, but the brains of the apps are always the same. So in terms of the performance and stability stuff, basically everything just runs better. They had a slide named Sweating the Details, which had 264 teeny tiny tiny little items, but the slide was up long enough for people to screenshot it. So they did, and God bless Adam Engst over in Tidbits, but he categorized it down into all of the different groupings of the little details. Fantastic overview of all of the little things Apple have tweaked. So if you're interested, link in the show notes, lessestalk.ie. An example of, it's not just knocking off the rough edges, it's also just making things faster and snappier. AirDrop up to 80% faster, and app launches 30% faster. Somewhat related news, Google is bringing AirDrop-like sharing to more Android phones. Even after the keynote, even after the conference, there is no sign of AirDrop being locked down to stop the Android devices from playing along. I don't know if that's just, well, that's only going to get us in trouble with anti-competitive regulators. I don't know, but it's interesting to me that Apple have not chosen to lock it down. I'm almost expecting them to announce that, oh, hey, it's a public standard. We got it certified for open source or something. I don't know. It's very strange to me, but it's continuing to happen. Now, obviously, rough edges being knocked off, you say. Are some of those rough edges liquidy and glassy? Oh, yes, they are. So, just like the very first version of Mac OS X was a bit much. If you want to have a really good laugh, you should look at Mac OS 10.0. Sorry, it was called... No, it was Mac OS back... Wait, OS 10. Yeah, it wasn't called Mac OS, it was just OS 10. Anyway, 10.0. The pinstripes were horrific. The transparencies were all over the place. It was what eventually became the wonderful UI we remember that Steve Jobs called lickable. But when he actually called it lickable, it was pretty over the top. It needed its rough edges sanded off, which is what it got. That's exactly what's happening to Liquid Glass. Also what happened when Apple went flat, whatever version of iOS where Apple went from skeuomorphic to flat, they went too flat. And then a year later, they dialed it back a bit and they gave us the iOS we know and love so much that so many of us threw our rattles out of our brams when Liquid Glass came along. Liquid Glass is following that pattern. The first iteration was too much. Basically, too big of a change, the right ideas, but dialed up to what turned out to be 11, and actually they should have only been at a 10. So this is actually what I expected to happen. Liquid Glass is getting its first revision, and a lot of the things that people are most cranky about from the past year look so much better in the latest liquid glass. Cultimac again, good roundup here. Five biggest liquid glass changes in iOS 27 and macOS 27. Thank you, Cult of Mac, for remembering that there are more operating systems than iOS. The headline feature is that instead of Apple trying to constantly trade off between what level of transparency people will want, like Apple's are trying to find some sort of a magic number that's just right for everyone, which is impossible, we now just get a slider. We don't have to go faffing around inside of accessibility features to turn on one or two pretty coarse features. We get a slider. And so those of us who kind of like transparency will keep that transparency fairly transparent. And those of us who are not me, frankly, those of you who hate transparency will probably crank the thing to solid as a rock. But it's fine. It's now your choice. You have the slider. macOS, thankfully, got most of the TLC, because macOS got the least of it in the first iteration. It feels like they ran out of time after iOS, and they got macOS to the point where it was ready to be the first developer beta, but they had to ship it because they ran out of time. So thank goodness macOS got a lot of attention in this first revision. We actually got applause from the developers watching live in Apple Park for the staggeringly simple announcement that consistent window corner radii. Like, the size of the roundy bit on the edges of your windows is going to be the bloody same. That, A, should never have been a gag line. And B, thank goodness that's fixed. Oh, thank goodness, thank goodness, thank goodness. The other thing that literally got the headline from John Gruber sums up my feeling as well. Sweet Jeebus! macOS 27 Golden Gate removes the dumb icons from menu items. Yes. Cluttering up the menu with pictures that are utterly meaningless, utterly inconsistent, and just visual noise wasn't better. That was a daft idea from someone who cut their teeth designing magazine layouts, not user interfaces, who, thank goodness, is now over with Meta ruining their stuff. Yay! Sorry, did I let that slip? How dire I thought Alan Dyer was? Anyway, this is not news to anyone listening to the show, and I've been recording long enough now that I'm allowed to get opinionated and go a bit loose here. Okay, so that's the most important. So corner radii and those bloody icons are gone. But there's lots more going on. There's a lot better responsiveness. The stupid things like not actually being able to see stuff in notifications. That stuff has just been so much smoothed off. It's amazing. In terms of what's going on with iOS, again, I'm not going to go through all of the stuff. But in fact, you know something? I'm going to yada yada through most of this. CarPlay got a bit of TLC, mostly small tweaks, but one of the big highlights actually is a dedicated videos app, which only works when you're parked, and nice little media controls that are sort of like little mini controls. They look really nice. Another little one that's worth sort of shouting out here is that you can now separately control the volume for alarms, timers, alerts, and the system sounds in general. Thank goodness. Something I definitely meant to say. If your iPad has the latest version of iPadOS, you will get iPadOS 27. If your iPhone has the latest version, you will even the iPhone 11 makes the cut. So basically, they're not cutting off devices here. Nice privacy controls added to how your location sharing works. That's a cool one. There's no major redesign in the camera UI, but there are some refinements. One of which is raw photo processing. It's a really big improvement. There's an entire tech talk on it, but wasn't mentioned in the keynote. And also we get a dual camera for FaceTime, if you want to show both your face and the thing you're looking at the same time on FaceTime, which is kind of interesting. And there's some Safari features that are called out, link in the show notes. RCS gets quite a bit of TLC to really sort of bring it on par with what people are used to from Blue Bubbles. And that most annoying microphone button that me and Justin Bieber, famously me, unfamously, keep on fat fingering on our phones and starting a bloody recording we didn't mean to. We can turn the bloody microphone off now. Yay. And really, I'm just going to leave you with the best review out there. Again, Mac Stories, I've been saying all along, they're doing an amazing job here. So their summary from Jonathan Reed, another one of these new names that I hadn't noticed before over in Mac Stories. But again, great to see them expanding their staff. As everyone looks to see whether the proof is indeed in the Siri AI pudding, it's good to see that Apple hasn't forgotten people still want tangible improvements in performance of their phones and iPads. Amen. Moving on then to macOS 27, which got the nickname Golden Gate. Basically, if you don't have an Intel Mac, you're all good. You need Apple Silicon to run these new operating systems on the Mac. And that's not really, or rather, given that fact, it's not surprising that support for Intel apps, which you can still run in Golden Gate, but that is now officially deprecated. If you're running any Intel apps in effectively Rosetta 2 mode, that'll work for Golden Gate. It won't work for whatever we call macOS 28. And we may not give it a fancy name because Apple have updated their support pages and taken the names out and replaced them with the numbers. Because that's actually quite a bit easier, because I know that 26 comes before 27. And I have trouble remembering whether Tahoe was before or after Golden Gate, etc., etc., etc. Another notable feature, ultra-wide displays get explicit support. Pull to refresh finally works on the Mac. I'm someone who does all of my scrolling on the Mac with the two-finger gesture on the trackpads. And because I'm such a big iOS user, I instinctively try to refresh everything by bouncing the scroll off the top of the screen with my two-finger swipe. At long last, that's actually going to be something that actually works for me on the Mac with macOS Golden Gate. So yay! And let me see. The Notes app gets another one I really like. Some markdowns, better markdown support. We had some markdown support. We have better markdown support now. Opinion again. Again, shout out to Mac Stories. This time is from Devon Dundee. An interesting mix of powerful AI developments, safety tools, quality of life improvements, and other features that may seem small in writing, but have the potential to make big difference in daily experience of using a Mac. WatchOS then, the big news here is lots and lots of models are not going to be able to run this latest operating system. The new features need a lot of oomph. So there are only 6 Apple Watch models that currently exist that will be able to run the new OS. One assumes there will be some extra models announced in September before these OSs go live to bring that number up a bit, but SE3 is the only SE watch that will work. The only regular watches are the Series 9, 10 and 11, and even the first generation Ultra falls away, only the Ultra 2 and 3 remain supported. Looks at wrist, thank goodness I upgraded to the Ultra 2 a year and a half ago. The older watches will continue to get security updates, but no more new features. And Apple basically explained that you need to have at least an S9 chip in there or it ain't going to work. Again, Mac Stories, Jonathan Reed, WatchOS 27 isn't a huge release, but there are still some very welcome features. TVOS 27 then, yeah, the link in the show notes is to an article from the Mac Observer. Here's everything new for the big screen OS, and I have in parentheses afterwards a very short list. There's very, very little happening. Apple are basically the only thing is they're cutting off some hardware, so the 2015 and 2017 models of the Apple TV hardware will not work. And the podcast app has been redesigned and we have some smart AI subtitle generation, which is useful. In terms of VisionOS, this is the first time that some of the features will only work on the M5 version of the VisionOS for the same reason, they need more power. Mac Stories are very obsessed, have always been because of Federico Viticci's interest in it, with the Apple Vision Pro. So they actually have a good write-up, even though not that much changed. Anyway, again, Devon Dundee. Between AI developments in step with Apple's other platforms, new spatial experiences, and continued iteration of key OS elements like Notification and Control Center, VisionOS has a lot to offer Vision Pro users. Something that gets a little bit less of a shout-out. So we have the big OSs, but we also end up with updates to other Apple products like AirPods. A big deal is that iOS 27 completely redesigns the AirPods settings feature within the iPhone, and that's no bad thing. And also we get a custom EQ settings for our AirPods, which again, that's a nice feature. And another nice little thing we get is that that AirPods heart rate sensor, that will now work with GymKit from an iPhone as well as from a watch, which is what you currently need right now. I'm going to shout out Apple Health because it's one of those every operating system ones that tends not to get noticed. And because a lot of tech journalists are male this year, Apple Health really flew under the radar. But you know something? Menopause tracking is a substantial feature that affects a heck of a lot of actual human beings, and it pretty well deserves a shout out. So I'm glad to see Apple continue to evolve Apple's health features, and I'm glad to see them not focus those features only on middle-aged white men. Not that I object to middle-aged white men getting health features, because I am a middle-aged white man, but I shouldn't be the only person getting health features. Services, then. Again, nice summary of what Apple announced over on Mac Stories. To be honest, it's not... Well, anyway, I'm going to call out a few. Apple Wallet got quite a lot of refinement, actually. Six key features is how the Cult of Mac summarized it. You know something? It's not a bad way to look at it. You can split restaurant bills by scanning a receipt. Again, some intelligent use of intelligence. You can turn physical cards and tickets into digital passes about bloody time. Smarter Apple Pay checkout experience makes it a lot easier to flip between cards. As someone who has too many cards in their Apple Wallet, thank goodness for that. You could also, assuming the stores start supporting it through the new APIs, do Tap to Share for your in-store loyalty card. That's another nice convenience for me. The loyalty card is sitting in Apple Wallet as a QR code I have to scan. It would be nice to just tap to pay or to, you know, tap to share. Richer hotel key experience. Again, it's going to require the hotels to buy in, but they have a pretty big launch partner with Walt Disney World going to use these new and improved features for their resorts. That's a big deal. And also new types of barcode are now addable to through the Wallet app, and there's new APIs to make all of that easy for app developers. Apple Maps got some TLCs, seven features worth calling out according to Cult of Mac. Flyovers get some AI-powered visual overhaul. If you're in the United States, local lists surface trending spots near you. They are curated based on anonymous Apple Maps usage data, so a mix of automation and human checking things out. Suggested places expands beyond just two recommendations. Trending restaurants get their own dedicated section. Natural language search expands to cover routing. Good use of intelligence. A parked car widget lands in the smart stack. Yay! When I park my car, that is exactly the kind of thing I want to automatically end up in my watch's smart stack. Thank you! And offline maps get improvements, but the details actually haven't been announced. So I like the concept, but that's kind of all we have at the moment. Another little thing in terms of services, shared albums now work with Android and Windows, and there are full resolution photos as well. That's not a bad update for people who have family members spread across all the different operating systems. Don't worry, we're getting near the end of our coverage, but you know something? It was the Apple Developer Conference, the Worldwide Developer Conference, so maybe we should look a little bit at, the developers' tools and actually the App Store, the main mechanism for getting our hands on those developers' great work. So, from a developer point of view, there are some Apple Intelligence changes. So, some developers, and the some is basically developers who don't have a single hit app, can get limited access to private cloud compute. So remember, all developers get full access to the on-device local models, the Apple Foundation models that run locally on your device. All of the apps already have access to them, and that's not changing. Apple have been the only people able to use private cloud compute for built-in features, and that is mostly still true, but some developers are getting to play around with it. This feels like a beta more than a real feature. It's probably a hint of where we're going to go. But basically, small developers who don't have any big apps can have a limited amount of processing in private cloud compute. Interesting. Apple have also made it bloody clear that app intents and the new personal context are absolutely the APIs you need to write your app to. The first attempt at third-party support in Siri, in silly Siri, was something called SiriKit. It is deprecated. It is going nowhere. Get on the App Intents bandwagon. Hey, bonus, your app will behave properly in the Shortcuts app too. And it's related, in the sense that it's part of the tooling, but it's not really Apple intelligence, but it's Apple enabling intelligence. Basically, Google Gemini coding assistant can be integrated into Xcode 26.6. Alla bloody Luya, Apple is cracking down on clutter in the App Store with stricter guidance. Lazy copied apps will be removed. Basically, just duplicating another app where some developers done all the bloody hard work and just copying it, go away, not welcome in the store. Yay. Repeat offenders, by the way, are getting stricter penalties. Basically, you could just lose your developer accounts. No, we won't remove your silly app, we'll just kick you off the store. Again, if you repeat offenders, bloody right. You were given a warning, you were still abusing Apple's customers, i.e. me, the user. Stop it. Now, this is where things get much more interesting, in my opinion. App Store overhaul gives developers new ways to sell subscriptions. So, the first of these is relevant to everyone. Group subscriptions allow one user to buy multiple copies of an app and invite others to share the use of that app. So, in a small office or a family context, that could be interesting, especially a small office where you don't want to have everyone on your family plan, but you do maybe still want to buy a copy of something for other people. Or if you're working in some sort of a volunteer organization and you're like, we should all be using Agenda, the amazing app to keep track of our meetings and stuff. Oh, yeah, no, it's not a free app. I'll tell you what, I'll just buy Agenda for all of us. Well, that was actually really bloody difficult before. Now it's easy. I can just get a subscription, say I want to pay for 4 copies of Agenda, and I'm going to invite Alison and a few other people. And no, don't get any ideas, Alison. I'm not offering you a free copy of Agenda. It's not actually a cheap subscription. No, you have to buy your own. Anyway, you get the point. And the other interesting thing then is App Store bundles allow multiple developers to work together to offer discounted subscriptions across multiple apps. So that's cool. And then the one that I gave a little ta-da emoji in the show notes, because with my work hat on, this is a really big problem. Apple School Manager and Apple Business Manager are how you do volume purchasing on managed devices. So MDM devices in a corporate and education world is done through the Apple Volume Purchasing Program, the VPP. And until the future, until this announcement, which isn't in production yet, you could buy apps, you could buy books, you could buy movies, you could buy all the media you wanted and assign it to managed devices. You couldn't subscribe to anything. So as Apple was pushing everything towards software as a service, the Apple School Manager people and the Apple Business Manager people were stuck only using apps that didn't have subscriptions because there's no way to volume purchase subscriptions. Until now. At long bloody last, we can buy subscriptions for our users in work, and people using Apple Business Manager can do the same. Amazing how that took this long to get here, but hallelujah, it's here. Interesting demo that Apple published at sort of the week after WWDC, a 90-minute video demo of Apple building a full app from a prompt. So again, when we say, oh yeah, just tell your IDE what you want, there's a lot more than just tell. But, you know, the prompting, it's an iterative process, and you can watch a 90-minute demo of how it really works. Very interesting. And finally, I've been drawing a lot of attention to the fact that Apple do genuinely seem to be getting serious about gaming on their platforms. And firstly, the Apple Game Porting Toolkit has reached version 4. So they haven't gotten tired of it. This is now the 4th iteration. And by all accounts, it's a big improvement. And it's getting support for agentic coding. And now we get perhaps to the more frivolous stuff. Tim Cook exits the keynote stage. This was Tim Cook's last Apple event as chief executive officer. He's not leaving Apple. He's sort of becoming Apple's chief diplomat, but he won't be fronting the next major Apple media event. So, farewell. His final thoughts were actually quite emotional. It's probably the most emotional I've seen Tim being on stage. And really, the pull quote is, honor of a lifetime, is how Tim described his time as Apple CEO. much more light-hearted on the other side of the keynote, released before the keynote, was a whole bunch of celebrities. It was a video of a whole bunch of celebrities sort of, you know, joking around, goofing about with Tim Cook's famous Good Morning opening that we will miss. I will miss his Good Mornings. It really did become a meme, and watching the celebrities sort of give Tim Cook fake advice on how to do his Good Morning, it was just light-hearted fun. It was a nice little tribute to Tim. I really enjoyed it. Link in show notes. And then, of course, we come to the analysis. There are lots and lots and lots of people who gave hot takes, but I don't really care about hot takes. I'm more interested in thoughtful analysis, so I'm going to shout out a couple of things. First thing, if you're a person who just wants the raw numbers, the stats, again, Mac Stories did us all a service by pulling out all of the stats and collecting them together. If you want the raw numbers, Mac Stories, link in show notes. If you want a good overview of the whole of WWDC, I'm going to shout out to certainly a friend of me in the podcasting sphere. I do a lot of work with Alison Sheridan, who works with Adam Engst a lot. So I consider Adam to be sort of a friend of the show indirectly. Anyway, Adam writes at Tidbits. Adam is the main person at Tidbits. And amazing content always at Tidbits. I've shouted out Mac Stories a lot in this show, but I should also shout out Tidbits, because that sterling work in Tidbits for literally decades. And it is by far the best overview of WWDC I read, so hat tip to Adam Engst. I will in fact quote sort of the top line summary from Adam. Although a few of the announced features undoubtedly doubled up internally, the three-part structure of the 75-minute long keynote was clearly reactive. Apple focused on user and developer complaints, parental concerns about technology abuse, and the embarrassment surrounding Apple Intelligence and the more personalized Siri it had promised 2 years ago. This was not the keynote of a company setting the direction of the industry. I'm really happy with what was in the keynote, but it is important to say that, yeah, this was Apple reacting to a couple of bum notes. 2 years ago was a very bum note. And last year's Liquid Glass was kind of a bum note. This felt like Apple's sort of mea culpa keynote. Okay, we heard you. And they made good, in my opinion. But it is important that this was a keynote in reaction to the community getting cranky. I like that they reacted, but it was a reaction. Hopefully next year we're back to Apple blowing our minds with stuff we didn't even know we wanted. We knew we wanted this, and we got it. I'm less cranky. I'm not even sure if Adam was being cranky, but a more forward-looking, positive approach from Jason Snell at Six Colors. His title of his piece was Realizing the User Automation Dream. The goal is always the same, to give regular people the ability to harness the power of computers. And we've never, ever been closer to that goal than we are today. Amen. Amen. And then finally, I'm going to end with another link to Six Colors, because these platform updates have planted some interesting little seeds that strongly suggest the rumor mill is onto something. So, touch support in macOS Windows displayed on iPad via Sidecar strongly hint at touchscreen Macs. Yeah, if you use your iPad as a Mac screen and you move a window from your Mac into that iPad screen, you can now touch that screen instead of using your mouse to control it, which is what you had to do before. That rather implies those long-rumored touchscreen Macs are coming soon. Another interesting little hint is that the iPhone app on the Mac, you can resize the windows. And when you run an iPhone app on the iPad, you can resize the windows. This very strongly hints at iPhones with adjustable screen sizes. Having a double-width iPhone app only makes sense in a world where iPhones can become double-width. I think this is a strong hint that the folding iPhone is a thing. Not proof, none of this is proof, but strong hints nonetheless. Nearly an hour and a half in and starting main story number two. No wonder my poor voice is starting this over here, but thankfully this is a much simpler story than, the Worldwide Developer Conference. Not a happy story, though. Price rises. Apple pre-announced that it would have no choice but to raise prices, and well, that was Tim Cook said that in an interview, and then the question was, well, when? Is this Tim planting a flag for the keynote in September? Friday came, maybe it was good, and we all sort of thought, well, maybe it'll be a bad news Friday news dump. Friday came, Friday went, nothing, and then the App Store, not the App Store, the Apple Store went down. Yeah, we kind of knew what was happening then, and then the Apple Store came back up, and oh boy, most things changed in price, and the price changes were not down. Oh no, oh no, 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 no. So, Apple were pretty clear about the why, and Apple tend not to write too much waffliness, so I'm just going to hand over to Apple PR in a statement they released, not as a full press release on their website or as some sort of a public post on apple.com. They released it as a statement to some trusted websites, including people like John Gruber. So let me just quote it. The consumer electronics industry is facing an unprecedented challenge. The rapid expansion of AI data centers has created an extraordinary surge in demand for memory and storage. We have never seen a component price increase this much this quickly. We have shielded our customers from these increases so far, but we have now reached a point where we need to begin raising prices on a number of products, including today's increases for iPad and Mac. We know this is not welcome news, and we are working tirelessly to find solutions. Yeah, okay, that kind of says it. For the rest, really, look, you can look at the prices. You can decide for yourself whether you still want the new Apple thing, or maybe you want the slightly, you know, less feature-rich model because you're going to keep your price point the same. Either way, what's really left here now is analysis. So the best overviews I have found were, firstly, a post from John Gruber. Spence of Thoughts was the clever little headline he used, and he built a useful table showing the percentage increases in the most important products. The product that did change, that changed by the smallest percentage change, was the Vision Pro. It only got 6% more expensive. But it's a $3,000 product, so adding on 6%, you know, it brings you up to $3,700, which is a hardly small number. The biggest percentage change is the poor Apple TV 128-bit, or not bit, 128 gigs. That went up a whopping 67%. It was €150. Now it's €250. Ouch. Dan Moran also has an interesting take, and he points out some of the other things that didn't quite jump out at me from John Gruber's story. First off, the MacBook Neo starting price, which is really one that Apple worked bloody hard to keep low, went up $100, is now $699, which is 17% rise. That's got to have stung, but they're selling like hotcakes, so if they're, you know, they need to retain their margins, that they were razor thin on that product to begin with. And at the moment, there are two very, very obvious product categories that did not get price increases. You know, a little thing you might have heard of called the iPhone and the Apple Watch. Now, we're in the middle of summer. The big September event is expected. It's not announced, but we're expecting it. And we're expecting new iPhones and new Apple Watches. I have a feeling those new models are not going to stay at the same price. Usually it's great new features, same old price. I think this year, great new features and, oh yeah, new price. Not so great. We shall see how that pans out. But that is the expectation. Yeah, no price rise yet on those product lines. If you want to dodge these high prices, strike while the iron is hot or get a time machine. So Apple made the announcement at a very interesting time. It's not as if it was a secret when Amazon Prime Day was, because Amazon don't keep that quiet at all, at all, at all. And Apple coincided their price hikes with Amazon Prime, which is a really good way to get all the cheap inventory out of the system at a really cheap price on Amazon Prime Day. Sadly, Amazon Prime Day is now in the past as I record this, which means it's definitely in the past as you listen to it, which means unless you got a time machine during Amazon Prime Day, you can't go back to Amazon Prime Day. Sorry about that. If, however, you are in some way connected to education, you can dodge some of the price increase by making use of Apple's education discounts, and Apple's back-to-school promotion as well, which might also help ease the burden a little bit. Finally, before we wrap up, just a few quick stories. Apple has been updating some of their software. The first one was Apple Invites. Co-hosting and guest list visibility finally arrive. The Apple Creator Studio got some nice tweaks to the editing tools and some nicer app integrations. iWork got an update. Actually, like, you know, a useful one, not just for the AI stuff you now pay for. Basically, a bunch of new features. None of them are earth-shattering, but they're actually quite nice. They're described by the Mac Observer as useful tweaks. And I was reading through them going, yeah, that is actually a useful tweak. So nice to see those apps getting some TLC. Final Cut Camera got a notable update. The new Final Cut Camera tries to be more useful for Mac users. So Final Cut Camera has amazing support for working with Final Cut on the iPad, and it's now got less bad support for connecting it to the Mac. You can't yet use it as a live feed, a live stream basically for live monitoring, but you can more easily get the files onto your Mac. So it's clear Apple are working to make that app more useful. And the iPhone 17 Pro gets an exclusive clean HDMI out feature via that Final Cut Camera app, which, if you're into video stuff, is potentially very useful. And finally, Beats drops Solar Buds in exclusive orange. And I should really put orange in all caps in the show notes because it's orange! And it's available in Best Buy and Japan. Best Buy is a store in the United States. Japan is a whole country. Okay, interesting choice of two venues, but there we are. If you want bright orange Solo Buds, you gotta go to Best Buy or Japan. Oof. Wow, that was one heck of a lot of Apple news for us all to digest. Thank you very much for joining me for the process. As usual, I will remind you that I've been your host, Bart Bouchotz, and I'll give you some links and stuff at the end, but just before we do, a giant big thank you to everyone who supports these shows, who has ever supported these shows. If you would like to help me pay the monthly bills, the most effective way to do that is to become a patron on Patreon. I have monthly bills, I have monthly Patreon contributions. The hope is that one will cancel out the other. They don't exactly cancel out each other, but we are close. Few more subscribers would be nice to get us exactly cancelling out. If you would like to make a one-off donation, PayPal is by far the easiest way to do that. And the PayPal donations are great because they fill in the gaps between what isn't quite coming in every month to meet the bills on Patreon, and they let me buy new hardware and software as and when needed. Yeah, so look, thank you to everyone who does support the show or who has ever supported the show. And remember, you can also support the show in way less financial ways by just spreading the word. Share the news with your friends and your family, right? You will have noticed, zero sponsors, zero ads, 100% listener supported, i.e. you folks all rock. The show notes, and they are very long this time, they took me 5 days to write, are at lessustalk.ie. This is a list of all of the reading I have been doing all month to get my brain in the right place to dump this semi-organized lot of stuff at you at the end of this month. I always put a lot of work into reading on the Apple News and digesting it into a monthly overview that adds genuine value. Takes a lot of reading, takes a lot of thinking, takes a lot of writing. But normally, I write the show notes in a day. 5 days. 5 days for this month. So lots and lots and lots of stuff in those show notes at lessustalk.ie. Okay, as I've already reminded you, I'm Bart Bouchotz. I've been your host. You can find my personal site at bartb.ie. Terrible, by the way, needs a lot of TLC, speaking of stuff that needs TLC, but that hopefully will happen this January, next January. Anyway, I've been your host, Bart Bouchotz. You can find me at bartb.ie, and until next time, happy computing.